Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I like Jim Ross calling New Japan in 2015, Paul Heyman calling Jim Cornette in 1988, and Ken Shamrock calling Spots in 1997. And I'm surprised Billy Gunn wasn't mentioned for today's podcast. Then again, there's disappointing, then there's just plain shit.
I'm Carl Jones, and I have a temperament that's about as calm and even-handed as Jim Cornette, and my personal appearance can only be described as Bastion Booger on a bad day. So it's quite remarkable when you think about it. When it comes to SCG trials, I'm the only member of the panel with a 2-0 record.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and for those of you who've asked, no, I don't find it important for my intros to be particularly relevant. Yes, people do say I remind them of a younger, better-looking Johnny Depp. And no, it isn't mandatory for all Squared Circle Gazette staff members to use the three-step intro process.
And I'm G. John Chase, and quite frankly, I was having a hard time trying to figure out which wrestlers disappointed me more. The Mantar, Arachnaman, the Dix, Kazani, Mordecai. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. This is going to be a good show.
This is the panel for the 20th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about the most disappointing wrestlers in history next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 20th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Aloha.
Carl Jones.
They actually call me Half Job Jones.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Aha!
And I'm very, very happy to be back with all of you today because we have a very, very interesting topic. The most disappointing wrestlers in history, as I've phrased it. It's actually going to be pretty cool because we've got so much feedback for this one. Almost 70 different suggestions for people that you think are disappointing wrestlers. A couple of different ways to kind of look at this. You can obviously look at this as guys who had such high expectations on them that, you know, inevitably fell short, or guys that you had heard so much about that when you finally did see them, it was a bit of a letdown. We're going to go around the table and give our takes, and as I said, we have so many suggestions from you, we're going to get to yours too. We're going to get through as many as we can, and we're going to start with Carl Jones' suggestion. Most disappointing wrestler in history to you, or is this just one that stands out to you like a neon light?
Well, I was going to go with Tom McGee, but then I quickly changed my mind.
Some people did say that, though.
Really?
Yeah.
But no, my choice definitely falls into the latter categorisation that you mentioned there, and mine is Sabu. Now, before anyone around the sort of panel gives me daggers, and I'm sure anyone who listens to this show will, some people will instantly feel aggrieved by what I've said there. But the reason I'm going with Sabu is that I won't deny there was a mystique about the character. It was a very unique look, and it was all very interesting the way, especially Heyman booked him in ECW, coming off the gurney initially and all that sort of thing. But I'd been led to believe he was so great and so innovative. And he was, don't get me wrong, in terms of innovation, the triple jump moonsault, Arabian facebuster, all those sort of things. Things I'd never seen before. But the reason he disappoints me is because he was hyped to such an extent, and more often than not, every time I say every time, maybe 90% of the time that I watched him, I just couldn't help but think, God, this guy's sloppy. Everything just comes across as so contrived. When a spot, it's one thing to blow a spot. It's another thing to then blow the spot and decide you're then going to rearrange the table so that you can get the spot just right. what's the theory? You blow a spot, you go to something else, and maybe try and work your way back to it. You don't say, knock the table off the chair, then decide, oh, I'm just going to leave the bloke there and go and pick up the table again and put it back on the chair.
Is this SummerSlam 2006 match of the Big Show that you're thinking of in particular here, Carl?
In terms of the rearranging of the furniture, yes, it is.
Yeah, I knew it was. I could just tell by the look in your eye.
But I would defy anyone to watch Sabu matches and tell me there weren't other instances like that. Maybe, you know, I'm picking the worst example there to emphasise a point, but I think you can look at enough of his matches to say, yes, there is evidence of that. It's not just a one-off thing, it's a general pattern with the guy.
It's a pretty interesting suggestion here for Sabu, because this is one that actually didn't come up in the feedback, which is why I'm glad that you mentioned him. This was a guy, obviously, via Power Slam and Paul Heyman's music video wrestling, was able to come across like the greatest wrestler in the world in 1994. And it's funny, because I'm reading Observers from 95 at the moment. Dave Meltzer's talking about how, you know, he's convinced the world that the Public Enemy are the best tag team this year, just like he convinced people Sabu was the best wrestler in the world last year. So a lot of that, I think, does come to that Heyman perception. We did talk about this a little bit on the ECW show a month or two ago, but Kieran, I can see you're jumping a bit to talk about Sabu.
Yeah, no, it's... I think, when did that change? Because it wasn't too long of people actually seeing Sabu, you know, formulating their own opinions maybe, that he got the sloppy rep. So I was trying to think, when did the sloppy rep come in? How long was it after people actually started, you know, seeing Sabu?
Yeah.
Because as we said before, I think that's half the battle. It was the paper reputation of ECW and the promotion behind it. It's
sort of more credit again to Master Manipulator Heyman.
You fucked up, Chance. We're there for Sabu matches in 96 if you go back and watch the ones with Van Damme and the Eliminators especially.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not sort of suggesting that Sabu in any way is the only person who's ever had sort of contrived spots and is the only person who's ever made mistakes in the ring. I just think that, and I do think, like I said, there was still a mystique to the character, and he did maintain that sort of legitimacy, I suppose, for lack of a better term, in the way he acted, not speaking and all that sort of thing. And I just think for someone who was given such a big reputation sort of on the indie scene, if you like, for lack of a better term, and for someone who had such an underground swell of support, when I watched him, I thought, yeah, some of the stuff he does looks really impressive. But I never sat there and thought, it's all particularly crisp, or this was a really good match. It's just this is Sabu, and there's a few cool spots thrown in, there's a few blown spots, and there's the end of the match.
Yeah, I think in terms of Sabu, I think my opinion's probably slightly harsher than yours. Because, like, in my mind, when thinking about this particular topic, I'm thinking about, like, someone that you thought was going to be good, as in, like, the long reach of what their career is going to be, like, how they're going to be, like, a figurehead or anything like that. And when it comes to someone like Sabu, pretty much straight away, as soon as I saw him, I just thought, well, this guy's just created his own glass ceiling on him just due to his style. And, you know, he was always going to be limited in terms of his career, so I don't think he actually had any kind of long scope. But, like, obviously, because I wasn't watching ECW at the time when all this was happening, I saw it in retrospect. And I'll be honest with you, when I was hearing about ECW and about, like, oh, how great it was and you should watch it, Sabu was not a name that came up. The name that I kept hearing was Rob Van Dam. Every time someone say, go watch, start watching ECW, it's done now, ECW's ended, but you got to go back and watch it. And the name they kept bringing up was Rob Van Dam. It wasn't Sabu. Sabu was just, I heard the name Sabu, but I didn't hear anything about it. So when I watched Anarchy Rules 99 and watched his match with Just Incredible, I was just like, okay.
Yeah, I think by that point, though, a lot of the Sabu influence and the kind of the spark off the end, the originality was somewhat gone. Because again, Sabu in 94, the popularity of table breaking and stuff like that, and the suicidal dives into the crowd and things of that nature, was a lot more commonplace by the time 2000 came along. And Sabu wasn't around much in 2000 in ECW. For the last few months, he was out of the company.
It was early in 2000, but
January,
he wasn't,
I think.
Yeah, he wasn't around too long before they had also the legal wranglings with WCW. But that's another story for another time.
Well, sort of another day, and like you said, the whole thing of Van Damme being the kind of the standout, yeah. I think was more just because he was fresh and original at that time.
Yeah.
And Sabu,
yeah, it's 2001. It was,
exactly.
So
from one end of the spectrum, from personal disappointment to a guy that had high expectations, Ahmed Johnson, Kowalski's killer from the Wrestling Forum. Ahmed Johnson came in looking like he was going to dominate wrestling for the next decade. His attitude quickly got him pushed down the card. El Bariqua from Pro Wrestling Only said the same thing. I always think of Ahmed Johnson. He had the look, a great combination of power and agility and presence. If you saw him at the end of 95 and the beginning of 96, you believe you're watching a huge star on the rise, but sloppiness, injuries to himself and his opponents, and other issues stopped all that.
The only thing Ahmed Johnson ended up dominating was the buffet table.
Ahmed did have some horrible time when it came to injuries, because it seemed like any time they were actually going to really kind of give him a shove a little bit, he got hurt, which is amazing for a guy that wore so many pads,
I was just wondering, was the because didn't he start off and he was a quite promising work, and but did he have a kidney injury? And he kind of
kicked him in the kidney and lacerated his kidney.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, and then he's got injured again and again and again.
Just cure something in my own mind here. What the fuck was with that attire?
Oh, I don't know.
With those multiple knee pads.
The multiple knee pads, that the hideous wedgie he always insisted on having.
Yeah, those. He had like the nose thing on as well.
Yeah,
the
back
nose
when that was cool.
The nose tape.
The
and like
foul nose tape.
Yeah.
Once you've got past the initial IC title win in 96, after that,
it's all
the bloom's pretty much off the rose for Ahmed.
Stop.
You just left a big T.
Yeah, which was no one's going to say that was a disappointment. That was just a disaster. And that was just bad. I do feel because Ahmed's initial push was kind of inspired by Bill Watts' 3-week stay in the company, because obviously, big black baby face. So the two things that Bill Watts wanted were Ahmed's mega push and Bret Hart with the belt back. That was Bill Watts' directive. And even though he left, they kind of, for a while stuck with Ahmed as a guy that looked like he was going to be something. But come 1998, after all the injuries, his performance in the Royal Rumble.
can't even
think about it without laughing.
He looked like he was blown up just walking down that little ramp.
He was in rough shape, and to the point where Bischoff in 90, after Johnson got sent his marching orders, he actually went to WCW to try and get a job, and Bischoff, who signed Crush for Christ's sake, turned him down. So what does that tell you about how far he'd fallen in such a short period of time? Dub J from the Wrestling Forum agrees, Ahmed has to be at or near the top of the list. This guy looked like he was going to sit on the top forever, and there wasn't anyone who could knock him off. Of course, now we know, there was one person that could keep him from ever getting to the top in the first place, and that was Ahmed himself. His promos were quite glorious as well.
For anyone who's ever got the Warzone game, yes. Those promos are legendary, but in their incoherence.
You know what? He did do what I thought was a really underrated one at the King of the Ring 96 before the Goldust match. Remember that way, someone tried to interview him about Goldust kissing him, and he just gave this death stare and said, "Leave me alone." Great. We'll get to another one here from, and his feedback has been sorely missed, the great Rick Morris from the FDH Lounge. blogspot.com. I'd say Shelton Benjamin, one of the most athletic and skillful guys ever, and he got buried because of politics. QJR voice talking on the Ross Report about how some guys would rather play video games in the back instead of their craft. The upset win over Hunter when he was at the height of his Triple H push should have set him up as a top tier guy, or at least upper mid card mainstay. But during the lean years of the mid 2000s, when the company didn't have enough great workers on top, they let him flounder. It wasn't like he couldn't talk either. Combined with the company's tendencies to undercut Mark Henry during his great Black Vader part of his career, and it really makes you wonder about the stories that Vince won't push black guys past a certain point. The Rock might be the exception, except for how much the company has pushed his Samoan heritage.
Oh, come on, Rick. They brought in his mama, for God's sake. They loved him.
I don't know quite about black thing. I mean, well, I don't know. If I threw Bobby Lashley in there? They kind of pushed him quite a bit.
They wanted to make him the star, didn't they?
Yeah, they did try with him. Shelton's a good choice, in 2004, because that was quite a tricky one, because obviously he gets drafted to Raw. I think he got was it a clean win over Triple H?
Fairly. There's the kind of, there was shenanigans on the outside with Benoit and Flair, but he pinned him with a roll-up.
There's a couple of wins that he got there, and I was just thinking, wow, this is pretty out of nowhere. Considering he was just a tag team wrestler for a while. And it just looked, for a brief period of time, it looked like they might actually do something with him. But it just seemed so brief of an opportunity.
Yeah, this is kind of that difficult distinction to your point, Chase, about the kind of the difference between a disappointing wrestler and the disappointing use of a wrestler. I guess it's kind of, it's two different subjects. On that point, though, do you think that Shelton Benjamin was really worthy of more than he got?
I was a massive Benjamin fan.
Yeah, me too. For about a year and a half.
Yeah. Which was the Shawn Michaels Raw match in during that period.
Yeah, 2005.
God, I love that match.
You always have to mention Shawn, don't you? Shawn with you.
Yes, it is.
Who did get a nomination for most disappointing, but we'll get to that later on.
Yeah, Benjamin. I was a massive Benjamin fan. But he's just a guy who just, I think, never got how to communicate with the crowd. He seemed very insular as a performer. In terms of personality, though, I think he was never going to be what I hoped he would be anyway. Breakthrough to be top level.
The upper echelon.
Yeah, he was mid-card and split in and out, it's fine. But I think personality-wise, he's never going to get there.
Because you think of any kind of major moment outside of that Shawn Michaels match, and they're pretty much all to do with ladder matches and Money in the Bank matches and stuff. It's all those kind of high
spots.
All those spots things. Just like Sabu, and it's just that thing of maybe that's just how WWE just saw him. He's just like, oh, okay, that's how you're going to make your name, is it? That's how you're going to get to spots, and that's it. And so I should just say, though, I am a Shelton Benjamin fan. I do like him. I'm just trying to rationale he wasn't used and why it was disappointing.
That's a fair point.
Kieran using the word insular is probably the perfect word to describe him, because there did seem to be that disconnect between himself and the audience. There was never, it seems somewhat try just to boil it down to a simple point, but something such as looking at the hard camera and things like that, things that were sort of missing there that would come, you would hope would come naturally to someone who's going to be in those upper echelons.
Yeah.
And where to look, what sort of facials, all that, all those little intricacies that tie in. But he was incredibly athletic. I thought he was a really good in-ring worker. Yes, there were the spots in the Money in the Bank match, but I always I always sort of attributed that to a, for God's sake, notice me, look what I'm willing to do just to try and get it, just to try and get another, you know, pardon the pun, but another rung on the ladder.
Yeah.
But I don't think he would have ever been the top guy in the way that maybe some of us would have hoped for. And just to clarify, Rick, I still love you, but there's no way the Cavaliers are getting past my Chicago Bulls this year.
Another stellar candidate here, Mr. Kennedy. A fanny pack from the UK Fan Forum. In late 2006, up to when he won Money in the Bank, I thought Kennedy was going to be the next top guy. Athleticism and charisma in equal measure, I thought. How wrong I was. A buzzard follower from the Wrestling Forum also says, Kennedy, he acted like such a dick during TV interviews after the Benoit tragedy. Lied, talked complete shit. And even more ridiculously, got caught himself ordering steroids online then tried to blame his doctor. He had a lot going for him before all that. Was the original choice for McMahon's illegitimate child, had the Money in the Bank contract, and was set to become the world champion. Once a very promising, soon-to-be main eventer in WWE, and he managed to completely fuck it all up.
Yeah, funny enough, like, Kennedy was one of the choices I was kind of contemplating for quite a while, because I did mention him on one of our first podcasts. Yeah, you know, Kennedy should have been, you know, a top star, in my opinion, at the time. It did seem like he was going to be, like, the next big thing. You know, he'd had, like, a feud with Undertaker, you know, and I think he had, like... did he have a title shot at Royal Rumble?
Yeah, against Batista, and the crowd cheered for Kennedy over Batista.
The planned storyline to be Vince's illegitimate love child and so on.
If I can just jump in there quickly, because I've always been curious about that. Is that one of those that was definitely confirmed that was going to be the way, or is that something that sort of just took a life of its own because people saw the Kennedy name?
Well,
it certainly wasn't Hornswoggle, but I always wondered if that was one of those where people tried to attach more to it than was ever really there. Is that...
No, that was the plan. The plan was that he was going to be the person who inherited the company from Vince when Vince blew himself up. They were going to do the love child storyline anyway when they did the whole Vince explosion. It was going to fall to Kennedy, and it was going to be Kennedy versus Triple H at WrestleMania in the main event, the stake of the company.
I wonder how that would have ended.
The disappointment was in the length of his career and what he did within his career. Obviously, the only person that can really be to blame for his career is himself. You know, going to TNA, I think for about 5 minutes, I was actually reasonably excited for him when he was in TNA, because I thought, like, oh, maybe you might be able to reinvent yourself a little bit, maybe gather some ground again. And then just, like, you just watch his TNA tenure, and it's just been absolutely awful. I mean, it's just, there's been nothing to it. He's just, like, nonplussed now.
It's a tough one, isn't it? I totally agree. It's like, it's hard to say, did the shit cannon from WWE really take his confidence away and he knew he was never going to get back again? Or is he a one-trick pony? Because, you know, he's got a bit of charisma. He can deliver lines. But he's, as you say, in TNA, he's done nothing. Yeah. You'd think the plus side of going to TNA is a guy with charisma has got the opportunity to actually do something individual and, you know, a bit different, break the shackles. But it's a complete waste of space for me. I completely agree with you.
Absolutely. When you look at the basic package of what Kennedy had, you know, as you said, like, you know, he did have charisma. He was good on the mic, you know. Okay, you know, we've talked before about, you know, just the one-trick poniness of his promos. But, you know, he was good at cutting promos. You know, he wasn't the drizzling shits in the ring. You know, he was good. I mean, like, you know, there have been worse people who have been pushed to the sky than Kennedy. And I just think, yeah, I think that was a general career disappointment of just a guy that promised so much earlier on and then just absolutely fizzled away. And when you think about Ken Kennedy, I also would add in MVP as well.
Well, funnily enough, Jimmy Redman from Pro Wrestling Only. I don't know if you saw this, but this is genius.
I didn't.
Mr. Kennedy and MVP in WWE. After the class of 2005, those two looked like the next surefire prospects to be elevated to main events. Kennedy was well on his way until he got injured and lost Money in the Bank and somehow never recovered. His unpopularity and backstage issues probably did him in, I would suggest so. MVP was done by the drug tester incident. It still annoys me when I see Kennedy in 2005, 2006, or MVP in 2007, and think about how far they should have gone and how they both ended up screwed. I'll throw this one to you, Carl, because you're about to make a point about Kennedy just before we went to that.
Well, the thing with Kennedy is, and we've touched on it a bit there, in that there's plenty of guys you will look at on sort of in feedback, and I dare say ones that we were thinking about ourselves, and we were trying to sort of narrow it down for one each for the podcast, where we were disappointed for. In a lot of reasons that weren't anything to do with the individual and more to do with the company.
Yeah.
And Shelton, someone I would use in that case, whilst I professed earlier that I don't think Shelton would ever be a top guy, I never thought he was given the fair chance to at least try and disprove that. When it comes to Kennedy, I think the complete opposite is true. I think, as we've said, this is a man who continuously shot himself in the foot.
Oh, yeah.
Did the company sour on him a bit? Yeah. But they were never given any reason not to. The way he behaved backstage, constant injuries.
The media stuff was the
dagger through the heart.
Yeah, it totally was.
But I must admit, yes, he was charismatic. I never thought he was that good in the ring, personally.
No,
I was never a big fan of Kennedy in the ring.
I don't think that was his appeal anyway.
No, but I think at some point, if you're going to be one of those top, real top guys, maybe I'm a bit naive in this respect, but I always think at some point you're going to have to, you know, bell to bell, you're going to have to be able to go.
The Kennedy one, I think this is a point that Luke Edwards made on the first podcast that we did, where we talked about how Kennedy worked very well within the WWE system of you know, ticking the boxes mentality that the WWE has, and he did fairly well in that. I'm curious as to what everybody thinks about MVP as a different talking point, because I never bought into MVP.
MVP, on the other hand, was slightly different. Okay, he had a very bad start, where everyone was just like, you know...
The Marty Garner debut.
Yeah, the Power Rangers and all that stuff, and it was just slowly over time where it started to work. I mean, like, I just remember, obviously, his feud with Benoit, which, you know, he had a good series of matches there. And then the moment which I thought MVP was going to be a big star was his feud with Matt Hardy when he was United States champion. And those two having a really good, in terms of, like, all the skits that they were doing, and, like, they become tag champions as well. I thought they worked really well together.
They did.
All the basketball contests and stuff. I remember all that stuff and just thinking, like, maybe there's something a little bit more here.
I don't think I ever liked MVP. I'm pretty sure I always hated him. not for me, not for the false charisma, not a good performer, horrible outfit. I just didn't like the guy. Didn't like the feud with Hardy. I thought that was stupid.
There's been a lot of drinking.
Distinctly didn't look forward to his matches. Not for me, so yeah, not fine.
Yeah. Familiar feeling on not looking forward to his matches.
Well, with regards to the Hardy feud, I always thought there was this underlying element of it was all too comedic. And when there's comedy...
The pizza eating challenge.
So, and when there's a comedic element, it always, to my mind at least, it always puts a ceiling on the effect, on how important a storyline can be for someone going forward then.
Money doesn't equal money.
Well, no, absolutely. But to disagree with Kieran... Oh. One of those rarities. I actually liked MVP. I did like the shtick. I enjoyed it. I always thought there was a ceiling to it. I never saw him as someone who was going to be one of those guys who was going to have a run with the top title by any means. But I enjoyed the shtick for what it was.
I just had the flashback to why I think I remember hating it so much.
You're going
to
say the same thing I am.
Because... I might not be, but the whole MVP sports superstar gimmick
should we show him? Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
This is the flashback.
Why has MVP got Shelton's gimmick of the super athlete?
Yeah, he doesn't. You don't need to say anything. You have your mouthpiece, you have your entourage, you wear a suit, have a diamond in your ear, and be a cocky superstar.
Yeah, be LeBron.
Yeah, be LeBron. And for me, MVP never pulled it off. The execution or the presentation.
Through the loins from the F4W board, it says Furnace and LaFon. Read nothing but incredible reviews of them in Japan, but they were nothing but unspectacular in the WWF. I believe injuries played some part in that. Kieran, this was actually one of the ones that you were going to suggest, right? Furnace and LaFon?
Yeah, not from any previous experience, because I hadn't seen them at all before when the Can-Am Express, when they were coming in. I just remember seeing the headline, like the article first of all in WWF Magazine, I think.
Yeah.
And then reading probably Power Slam and getting the kind of a bit of the gist of the background of the two of them. Expectations were like sky high that we're going to, these exciting dynamic. It's that rollover of the ECW thing again. It's the same thing.
Reputation precedes itself.
Yeah, and then I can't even remember.
Good debut at Survivor Series, I thought.
No, I really enjoyed their debut. It was sort of, there was just enough sort of intrigue from the in-ring stuff they'd done to see where it went further down the line. I think the problem with Furnace and LaFon is that it's one of those where the reputation stemmed, and correct me if I'm wrong, the reputation stemmed largely from Japan.
All Japan, yeah.
All Japan Pro Wrestling. And it's somewhat cliched to say, I know, but it's still that more, sort of in Japanese circles, it's the sport element and really competitive, good in-ring matches. And it doesn't translate when you get over to the WWF, where these two guys are really crisp and good in the ring, but there's no hook for them. Yeah. You know, no one's ever going to accuse those two of being overly charismatic, are they?
Well, that was the thing. Lafon had lost a little bit of the zing from his fastball through injuries. Mm. But on the point of personality, do you remember what they did with them?
No, go on, remind
me. They had them as the boring guys.
Ah, there you go.
The whole thing with Bulldog and Owen, once that was done, and that only lasted a couple of months, yeah, that, they that had was, nowhere
that
left
much,
to go.
That was pretty much over by the Final Four pay-per-view.
Final Four, that was the time.
But it was just... And to go back to that word Kieran used, it insular is a great way to describe those two when it comes to their WWF run. And like you say, because that initial hook wasn't there, because they weren't sort of overflowing with charisma, it then just becomes a fait accompli from the company who decide, yeah, okay, this isn't really working, we think they're dull, but rather than have them prove us wrong, we're just going to ram that home.
I had the Survivor Series 96, yeah, as you referred to, and so I saw that match, and I just didn't think that was a particularly impressive debut for my part, though I do know of a debut from a Survivor Series that was impressive.
And this segues very naturally into G. John Chase's pick for most disappointing wrestler.
Yes, my disappointing wrestler is going to be Scott Steiner. Bit of backstory here. Like, I was watching WCW back in 2000, and there wasn't a lot of good things going on in that company to look forward to. One of the few things that was good was Scott Steiner, okay? Because he was still excellent at that time. He was world champion. He was kicking ass, and he was just freaking awesome. So we jump forwards to, like, 2002, and I'm with my mate Dean, and we're watching the Survivor Series 2002. We were already hyped over the show, and I just remember watching that really fucking lame Matt Hardy, Chris Nowinski segment, and then just that siren blares, and Hollow If You Hear Me shouts out, and me and Dean just lost our fucking minds, okay? I mean, we got up out of our chairs, we were cheering like a couple of teenage girls at a One Direction concert. We were just up and down, and, you know, and unfortunately, this entire moment, this debut was probably the best part of his secondary run in WWE.
Like Miles.
You know, give me the fucking mic! You know, and then just like decimating Matt Hardy and Chris Nowinski with suplexes. And I just remember at that time, just being so fucking hyped that Steiner was in the company, right? I was like, oh, fucking hell, this is amazing. Big Papa Pump, Big Booty Daddy's in the company. He's going to fucking kill Triple H. He's going to take his title. And then, yeah, it didn't happen at all. You know, we jump forwards to Royal Rumble. But actually, before we go to Royal Rumble, we'll go up to the freaking build-up to that, which is fucking atrocious. How do we build a match between Scott Steiner and Triple H? They have fucking pose downs, fucking arm wrestling wars, thumb wars, whatever. They have these fucking ridiculous things.
I find that totally believable that would Triple H and Steiner would argue over that shit.
Do you not think the pose down could have worked if Jesse Ventura was there with his award?
Or Triple H, just like Rick Rude, had that freaking like pump, that that bar pump, whatever.
Lex Flex.
The Lex Flexer. Yeah, I just remember just watching that whole build, and I was just like, what the fuck is this? You just get to that Royal Rumble match, and it was just like this massive, putrid pile of fucking congealed monkey vomit of a match, which was just, you know, obviously completely overshadowed by Benoit Kurt Angle, which it wasn't hard for them. All they had to do was walk out, and they topped him. And it was just, I just remember just watching this match, and just like Triple H just being absolutely horrible, and just like, and just watching Steiner and just going like, what the fuck's going on here? Because again, I didn't know anything about what had happened to Steiner. I was just like, drop foot syndrome. Didn't know anything about that. I was just watching him going, what's wrong with Steiner? And like, he's taken a little longer than a man should to get back up onto his feet after doing a suplex. And he said he looks really uneven on himself. And I thought, like, sure, he's not that inflated by now that his body's just like falling over himself. And it was just, I just remember just thinking, Steiner's done.
Yeah,
Steiner's done.
Dude, you sound like a teenage girl who went to a One Direction.
One Direction.
Only to find out she actually bought tickets for Cliff Richards.
Yeah, topical.
But what we have right here in Chase is a freak who never howled at the moon.
And you could just see how unsuccessful that whole angle was, because he wasn't even included at WrestleMania 19.
No, they signed him. They didn't even put him on WrestleMania because they did such a poor job, and he himself massively underperformed. Although his Crimson Thong did appear twice, which is nice. In both matches. Again, this is part of the horrible Ric Flair cosplay period of Triple H, where he let Steiner rip his clothes off, so you're down to his underwear. Not good stuff at all, but I don't think that there's really much argument around this table that Very, very disappointing performances from Steiner.
It was very disappointing. Very disappointing.
It was, but in truth, I don't think I was ever expecting that much going in. Because, I was thinking, and I didn't know about the drop foot syndrome at the time, but I just thought, this is a guy who's been away from the ring for so long. He's that jacked up, he can barely, you know, regardless of the drop foot syndrome, it was a situation where he's that jacked up, it probably limited his mobility anyway.
Yeah. So, heading back to the feedback, Shayna Mack version 2 from the UK fan forum says, Sin Cara is one of the most disappointing wrestlers of all time. One of Triple H's first signings, lots of hype surrounding him, huge deal in Mexico, the next Rey Mysterio, and he shit the bed. The thing I'll remember most about him wasn't all the botches, it was the fact that he legitimately quit a match because of a dislocated pinky. What a pussy.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good one, yeah, because, God, he was really overhyped when he came in, you know, just obviously a bit of Mr. Co. The only kind of high point for me was Sin Cara's when Sheamus powerbombed him through a ladder.
Which injured him, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I know, that was the fun part.
No, it was the angle to injure him because he was going to serve a suspension.
That's right, well
responded. Drug, wasn't it? Yeah, drug taken.
The thing with Sin Cara, and you mentioned Mysterio there, and I think that's what they thought they were signing the next Mysterio. The problem was... Or sort of the short-sightedness of the company is that Mysterio had been wrestling in the US for a good 8 years by the time they actually bothered to sign him.
Yeah,
you know, 7 or 8 years. So he was already accustomed to a US style and had been able to adapt his style into that. They've signed a guy from Mexico who's never worked in North America as best
didn't
as
speak
I can
the language.
Tell. Didn't yeah, speak the language. Thing, yeah. You know, so there was no. Quick, far way for him to sort of mesh his style in with the WWF, and they had this theory of, oh well, we'll stick him in with Chavo Guerrero and everything will be all right. Chavo Guerrero, who, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have a long CV when it comes to wrestling in Mexico.
No, 2 years he was wrestling before he got to WCW.
All
so
good matches.
So Sin Cara, huge disappointment. Any further words on that?
No, I think again with the reputation, legitimate biggest star in Mexico at one point.
Yeah.
Young, don't think he'd had many injuries at that point, so yeah, expectations of hoping to see something, an updated Rey Mysterio, yeah, didn't happen. Not all his fault, I mean, that the lights were shit.
Yeah,
I mean, really, really bad.
Moving along here, Tiger Rick from the UK fan forum, that Benoit fella was a bit of a letdown. Way to make a good impression on the business, Chris.
I'm not touching that one.
Disappointment is something you like tut and shake your head at and say no, son. that's not murder. Double murder, suicide.
Naughty, naughty.
No, sorry to get into a semantic argument, but not for me.
Yeah. Maluko from TPWW Forum says, The Big Show should have been a top name for over a decade in the WWE, but he has just been used to get others over. For those who say he was no Andre, he didn't have to be. He is charismatic and not a bad actor when he's given something good to work with. Feel like we saw glimpses of it as ECW champion, for example, but he should have been a main attraction, multiple-time champion, much more than he has been, and a legend in the business. People might argue that he's done it all, but he could have been so much more of a star. Despite shining brightly a few times in WWE, feel like he could have and should have been so much more.
The problem for Big Show is that he liked his diet of pizza and milk. Anyway, and as his weight went south, so did his push.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good pick, actually. It was one I was thinking of. Again, thinking back to the exact time scale, we've got the war going on, so it's the excitement of who's going where, switching sides, and we've got this guy, he hasn't been in the business too long. You know, 2-3 years, whatever it was at the time. You got to remember as well, when he's only probably 18 months removed from being this freakishly athletic big man.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, say he got his 10-year contract and he spent it all on pies that first week. And, yeah, about 3 weeks later he got turned. I know he lost to Austin. Yeah,
that was the thing. In his first TV match, I think he lost to Steve Austin clean in the middle.
Which, yeah, do you think they did the debut, was it Valentine's Day Massacre?
Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yeah. Although I see the temptation to go opposite Austin straight away to, realistically, the way that the company works, they would set themselves up to fail.
Obviously, they'll just kind of go with any opportune time that they could get him, but I don't think debuting 1 month before WrestleMania was necessarily the best thing for him either.
Look, when it comes to the Big Show, there was a culture at WCW that didn't necessarily reward the hard work in the first place.
And that wasn't Eric Bischoff's fault.
No, we've already established that. But the fact is, everyone gets a little bit excited about the Big Show's athleticism because he threw a drop kick once on a Clash of the Champions. All right, whoop-de-fucking-do. Right, after that drop kick, Yes, his attitude starts to stink in WCW, but he has the chance to reform himself in WWF, and he doesn't do it when he gets the big contract. He decides he's going to stuff his face anyway, and he just doesn't care. So at the end of the day, I put all the blame purely on the broad shoulders of the Big Show. Paul White, it's your fault you're disappointed, not anyone else's.
CS from Pro Wrestling Only, Nathan Jones. He was shit in the ring. Yeah. He was shit in the ring, but his vignettes were incredible. Some of the best vignettes WWE has ever produced.
Nathan Jones, guy.
Those vignettes weren't good.
They were. Yeah. They were awesome.
Oh, no, what? That whole kind of like the fake like fucking news report or something.
No,
like
they were real. That's the whole point. They were real news reports. He was convicted for armed robbery. They were legitimate news reports from Australia. Oh. That's the whole point. That's why they were so awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, there you go. Wow. That's what I thought. He legit did jail time for armed robbery in Australia.
Oh, wow.
And those
were
the news reports.
How the fuck did they catch him?
The Colossus of Boggo Road,
it's fucking
right?
Fucking huge.
Yeah, but
he had no coordination. Didn't you watch his mic?
Yeah. Did you see him trying to do that spin kick on the episode of SmackDown? Yeah. And he fell over.
I tried to do it on a copter and he just fell on his ass.
Mertz from the UK fan forum. I remember, speaking of vignettes, I remember really looking forward to Mordecai. His promos were pretty good and thought he'd be a cert to go against The Undertaker, and then he made his debut. Shit. Eloquently put, sir.
Oh, God.
Mordecai.
Really, the Pale Rider. Really, did anyone ever think Mordecai was going to be anything?
It was an interesting first few vignettes, though. What they're going to do with him. And then, so I'm not sure if that's on him or do you put that on them. But it was interesting what they're going to do with him, I think.
It's more on the company for me, because the vignettes were interesting. But I wouldn't say any more than interesting, because I'd sit there and think in the back of my mind, and maybe this is just, you know, me being as jaded as I am, I think, God, this is hokey. The thing is, I think to the emailer's point, the idea was to put him with Taker originally, I believe. But I think, you know, you can have with the best will in the world, you can have great vignettes. When your debut match is against Scotty Too Hotty on a pay-per-view... Oh. You know, you can only polish a turd so much.
And what was the follow-up pay-per-view performance? Do you remember that one, Carl?
It was Bob Holly's anus, I believe.
It was Bob Holly's anus in a match that was... Because the thing, I don't know if you remember this, but the SmackDown before the Great American Bash, they did a Mordecai vignette where he kind of challenged, or implied a challenge to Eddie Guerrero, who was the champion. And I remember hearing that promo, and just my stomach turned like, this is what they're going to do with Eddie. After Bradshaw, we got fucking Mordecai. Turned out we wouldn't even get that.
We wouldn't get that far.
We gotta go to, if we're talking about the most disappointing wrestlers of all time, we can't not mention Sid. C4 from the Wrestling Forum. Sid Justice. He was signed by the WWF in May of 1991 with the intention of making him their replacement for Hulk Hogan. He debuted with a monster push at SummerSlam and does get the main event of WrestleMania 8 and set to have a premier feud that spring with a returning Ultimate Warrior. But at this point, he's nowhere near close to being the next Hulk Hogan. He's rather the next Paul Orndorff of 1986, at best the top heel. He leaves the promotion in late April 92, a tremendous amount of bad luck on Sid's part. Bad news Gertner from the TPWW forums mentioned Sid. He had opportunity after opportunity and kept shooting himself in the foot. He could have taken the reins from Hogan in the WWF. Amazing look, intense promo, charismatic, marginal worker, but who cares? So was Hogan. Softball Sid just never did reach his potential. We got one more here from Flange Dango from the UK fan forum. I might have to go with Big Sid on this one, unfortunately. For all the look and intensity he had, it all went to buggery when it came to putting on a credible performance in the ring. He could do the basics alright, but he was never convincing enough for me. Probably the worst slugger around too, as his punches were the fucking worst. And if you need proof of that, watch the end of Mind Games.
The running with Vader. Yeah. They really were the shits. I think that email is being kind by even saying he could do the basics right.
Yeah.
I take great offence to the sentence that equates him to Paul Orndorff, because Paul Orndorff could work.
I think he just means heel who turned on Hogan, that like, of the month kind of a thing. Not necessarily comparing them as a work, but just saying the whole thing of he was supposed to be the next Hogan, but he ended up just turning on Hogan to lose to him.
In which case, I apologise, but still, Orndorff did business with Hogan. They drew money.
Yeah, that's the difference.
The only thing that Mania match drew was shoppers who were getting coupons for the Hoosier Dome. Don't get me wrong, if I seem sort of trite with the way I dismiss that there, Sid should have been one of the top guys. You know, the raw look and intensity was there, but he's just another guy who just, there was absolutely no passion there, didn't care, and, you know, Why has he got the nickname Softball Sid? Because he wanted to piss off and play softball.
Yeah, I remember Meltzer referred to Sid once as the best wrapped Christmas present of all time when there's nothing inside the box.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, I agree with you on that. Like in terms of like a general look and like intensity, even though like those promos were a bit kind of strangely funny, you know, like. Oh, Jesus.
He sucked
so badly. And in fairness, it doesn't matter how good a push he would have got. The main thing that stopped Sid from being a star was Sid because he's a fucking moron. That's like the main thing. Like whether half the stories about him are true or not, the fact of the matter is that there are... Yeah, that one's a big one. But, you know, the fact that even if half the stories are freaking true...
Is that why they called him Psycho Sid, by the way?
Yeah, that's what they call him.
Dude, that was his music. Remember?
Yeah, but I know. It just dawned on me.
It's the stabbing.
Yeah. Hang on a minute. Maybe I knew that before.
That's classy, that is, isn't it?
Yeah, for me, he wouldn't fall into most disappointment because he is, for me, what he sees, what you get. he's a shit big man.
Along over the litany of list of shit big men.
Yeah, exactly. For me, he's... just another one on the shit big man list.
Really. What do you think about this whole idea that at one point, especially when, you know, early in his WCW run, when people saw this raw piece of clay who looked like that and could talk fairly well and was charismatic in a strange kind of way, even though he didn't really draw ever anywhere, he got chance after chance after chance. So I can see that, you know, obviously disappointing. Did you ever think he could have been anything more than he was when you saw him?
Well, I think the first time I saw him was when he was wearing that ridiculously tight referee shirt at...
SummerSlam,
yeah. And just as a kid, just remember looking at him and just going like, no. No, I'm not having this. This guy doesn't look like he's going to be anything. I mean, Hogan, obviously Macho Man fan I am. I thought like, yeah, Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, one thing. But like this guy, no, not at all.
No, I mean, he got the push that he's probably deserved. But, and then his talent kind of paid that off exactly. Yeah, that for me, that's the story of Sid for me. You got the push that's going to... That his look would, you know, you'd expect, and then the follow up that his talent also gives you. So not a disappointment for me.
But he won both WWF and WCW world titles, which is mind blowing.
Even more than that, that really chaps my ass is that he main evented two WrestleManias. You think of like other stars who didn't get the chance to main event WrestleMania, or only main evented WrestleMania once. Yeah, he main evented it twice.
Yeah, and the Hoosier Dome had a hell of a lot of papering, and WrestleMania 13 that year it was outdrawn by Uncensored 97.
Yeah, the lowest drawing WrestleMania of all time.
Yeah. So there you go. That speaks to Sid. I understand what you're saying, Liam, about the sort of the diamond in the rough, if you like, the unmoulded piece of clay, and I can see why someone would maybe give him that initial push in the first instance, easy for me to say. But it's an indictment on both companies that they continue to go back to the well, where not only was it dry, there was never any water there in the first place.
Especially in 99 in WCW. It's like all the people to turn to push as the top
Absolutely.
Guy.
Well, that's just the stage where Bischoff's throwing shit at the wall and seeing if anything will stick. But he wasn't guilty.
Hey.
But let's not forget he got over an ECW, and the ECW fans are smarter than the rest of us.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Monster heel from the board at FOWonline.com, D'Lo Brown. One of my most loved mid-card acts of all time. He was a standout in a horrible WWF mid-card in the late 90s. I don't think he was a main eventer in any universe, but he had a longer shelf life than he got. There was no reason for him to become a jobber or be floundering around on the independents. There's a reason why he's remembered fondly. He was perfectly cast as a second-tier champion. Tom Geikart from TPWW Forum echoes this sentiment. I would have to say D'Lo Brown. D'Lo is one of those guys who would have benefited from jumping ship to WCW and coming back to WWE later up the card in a fashion similar to Jeff Jarrett.
So he thinks that it was being a good idea in what 2000 for D'Lo to jump ship to WCW.
Well, as a matter of fact, in 99, when D'Lo's push pretty much ended after the whole Drozden thing, it was compounded by the fact that Russo was negotiating with D'Lo at the time. When they found out, they put him on the back burner, and that was the end of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think the emailer there sums up D'Lo nicely and sort of the role he should have had. I was a big D'Lo Brown fan at the time.
Me too.
I was down with the Brown, don't get me wrong. But I love the chest protector gimmick and the fact that the European champion who was from different cities from all over the continent every other week. You know, D'Lo did it first, Al Snow, screw you. But he was never going to be a top guy. But I thought there was a... It disappoints me, sort of, the way he was treated. And I think he certainly deserved better than to be Chaz's tag team partner. Or even worse, with Tiger Ali Singh and the Raja and Barge skits, you know, which are all about, you know, us around this table and probably six other people remember. But God damn it, they scarred me.
Yeah, I was, again, yeah, just like you guys, I was a big fan of D'Lo Brown, the first Eurocontinental champion.
Yep.
I don't know how long he could have lasted in the company, but I think he certainly could have lasted a couple more years at least. And I don't think he could have been like a big star, but he certainly could have been a showcase guy in that mid-card. I think that they just didn't use him properly.
I think I probably say this on every podcast I'm on, but the D'Lo thing is that from that time frame in the Attitude Era, and Rock's just come through, and it was and especially WWF at the time, it was the creation of stars. We're getting new stars, and you know this kind of the potential we always let us stay in now. When you get a jump start, they carry through Austin, Rock, Foley, etc. And D'Lo was. He was the next one in line. It's like, he's a fun, charismatic guy. And so the draws thing, I always thought, that kind of knocked his confidence.
The two things happened pretty much at the exact same time.
And and that contract as well, which is obviously the push show. Yeah.
And by the time that, and that was the thing, by the time he was, how long did they put these guys on the back burner? You got to remember, the mid-card changed drastically when the Radicals came in, two or three months later. So by the time D'Lo was, I guess, earmarked maybe to come back and do something, the landscape had completely changed. It's interesting because a guy like Val Venus stuck around an important role in 2000, despite really not showing the charisma to hang at that level. And D'Lo, who just so shortly before was so promising, got completely written off.
A little pudgy, and I'm sure they found things they didn't like about him. Would he, even without that, what would he have been though? I it's impossible to say, but I just think we probably, as fans at the time, got carried away with Rock, and Rock's fucking...
I don't think he would have been Rock champion.
No, he probably wouldn't have been. I think maybe, you're right, Kieran, we did get carried away a little bit, but he could have been more than what was tantamount to a glorified jobber as we go into the year 2000 and onwards with what remained of his WWF run.
A copy from Pro Wrestling Only from another disappointing wrestler, Glacier. WCW hyped the shit out of that dude. Then he has this big elaborate entrance and entrance attire and shit, and he just wasn't very good at all. He was a lower mid-carder most of his run too. The way they hyped him up with the Glacier is coming stuff, I thought he was going to be a big deal. Not just a dude with a Sub-Zero rip-off gimmick doing headlock takeovers. Ruin from TPW agrees with Glacier, who was not hyped for him, and he was just straight garbage.
Hot steaming garbage, to be out. The thing is, we mentioned Nathan Jones earlier in the vignettes and the way that sort of that built up expectations that couldn't possibly deliver. I defy anyone to go back and look at those Glacier vignettes, even for 1997.
They look so cheap.
And not find them to be so such absolute horse shit. You go back and watch that. Even for 97, they look cheap.
Yeah.
So is it any wonder? This was one of the few faults in Eric Bischoff. And this was his old, I'm a karate guy, let's get a karate guy in. Oh, Mortal Kombat's a good selling video game, and they've done a movie recently. Let's just, this is Bischoff, marketing man going a mile a minute thinking, let's merge it together and bring this guy in.
That's the whole thing. It's not just the vignettes. First of all, I don't know how much money they really did spend on those vignettes, to your point, Carl.
Probably not as much as they imply.
No, and I think actually they, if I remember right, they actually hired people to design the characters for Blood Runs Cold, and they were like the big money resource, was they paid people to come up with the names and characters and outfits and costumes to create basically Mortal Kombat with a little bit of a spin. Massive disappointment in terms of, because those vignettes ran forever too. They were running for months, it felt like.
Yeah, I can't remember the actual vignettes themselves, but I remember he was probably like a big deal.
Yeah, great entrance.
Yeah.
I think he had the Sin Cara blue lights too in the early going, if I'm not
that's
mistaken.
Kind of
yeah.
Like that, and didn't he have like kind of that snowy shit?
The snow coming down from the ceiling.
And then two or three months later, he was wrestling with Ernest Miller. So what does that tell you?
Yeah, it tells you all you need to know. We're going to get on to the next one of ours, and it's going to be mine, in terms of somebody who was a big disappointment for me personally. As a youngster, reading as much as I could about professional wrestling, so I was getting into it, and seeing bits and pieces of WCW Worldwide before I became a full-fledged fan in 1992, I would hear a lot about Dr. Death Steve Williams, and when I actually finally got to see him in WCW, and this is something we talked about in the past, but there was just this thing about Doc and Gordy as a team that really didn't captivate my imagination for a team that had a great amount of hype and a great kind of mystique about them in the early 90s in WCW. I couldn't really get into Doc at all, and when he left, yeah, as the years went on, I would continue to read in Power Slam about how great he was in All Japan, similar to the Furnace and Lafon thing we talked about earlier, not actually getting to see any of this stuff as a kid, and he's coming to the WWF in 1998, so we're finally going to get to see Dr. Death. And then when we finally do, he gets knocked out by the Cowboy, and we pretty much never ever see him again, apart from, I think, one or two cameos where he's dressed in, like, a red kind of kung fu outfit, if I remember. Do you remember that, Carl?
Where, like, orange boiler suit.
Yeah, borrowed from Nails, I think, with the arms cut off, and wearing a hideous mask, which I'm sure no one really remembers. But it was, like, one... I think he's, like, doing, like, a Bob Holly Bart Gunn hardcore match on Raw, if I'm not mistaken.
Shockingly enough, I don't remember this. WWF did a DVD release of it was one of their Best of Raw series. It was Volume 1, Volume 2.
Right.
And that's actually, that match is one of the extras on Volume 2. That match with the running where he throws old Cowboy Bart off the stage through a pallet.
Yeah.
You know, think about that. The Attitude Era, it's probably just before Bart Gunn's knocked the fuck out by Butler. But we're talking that period. So a red hot period, and that is a match that makes the DVD.
Yeah, I know. And that's his legacy, you know, to WWF fans. It's
that,
crazy.
His legacy is that and the temporary JR heel turn, which lasts about 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. But that did have the great JR is Raw table.
That was gold. That was gold.
The table they built at ringside for JR is Raw, and he's like, you know. We never really got to see anything of him in America that was really all that special, and it was only when I finally did get to see the Old Japan stuff and just been completely blown away, like, this is a completely different guy. Like, seeing his matches with Kenta Kobashi, and yes, it's Kenta Kobashi, but... you know, there's a match from August of 93, I want to say, with Doc and Kobashi, which is just absolutely awesome, with the backdrop drivers, you know, the repeated backdrop drivers. Just awesome stuff. And it's funny seeing, like, okay, this is the legacy, this is the reputation. But at the same time, for so long, associating Dr. Death with disappointment every time I saw him.
Dr. Death in WCW with Gordy, that we talked about before, the how pushed they were. And they were so pushed, and I can't remember them seen a match with them on, if I'm perfectly honest.
Yeah.
Just, and then, or just nothing, obviously nothing that tickled my fancy. And then going to WWF, and I can just, in that Brawl for All, I can just imagine Vince turning to JR and going, "You told me he was a badass!" and after that, it's like, well, fuck this guy. Yeah, so massively disappointed. I mean, yeah, disappointing because could you have done more? I don't know. Could you have done more? I mean, given the personality requirements in America in general,
he may have had a short shelf life with regards to WWF in 98 and sort of early 99. But I think you can certainly do better than sticking him in the Brawl for All. And the Brawl for All was just it was a hideous concept from start to finish.
It was a horrible idea. Executed even worse. Yeah,
as bad as it looked on paper, in execution they made it far worse than they could have even dreamt to.
And the only one upside ended up going to pot anyway with Bart. So that's just, you know, it's even more ridiculous when you
really
think
about
it.
Yeah, but it was a great knockout at Mania 15.
I enjoyed the one when Bart knocked out Bradshaw far more.
Yeah,
I'm sure plenty of rookies did as well.
London Kendrick are big fans.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is that him and Gordy are very much one in the same when it comes to North American runs. Like I say, and I don't want to...
Well, in the major companies. Sidebar, Mid-South and Dallas.
Yeah, in the major companies, because, as you say, in much the same vein as Dr. Death, my first memories of Gordy are the execution stint. Yeah, and you know, and we're talking about after he's had his health issues,
his coma,
and sort of all that entails. And then you go back, and I haven't seen an awful lot of the Japan stuff, but you see some of it and you think, like you say, this is why they talked about these guys, and I can see why people thought the way they did now.
Yeah.
I'm going to put also, when looking back, particularly around like that 98, kind of 99 period with Dr. Death, I'll also put Dan Severn in there as well.
The thing with Dan Severn is that a lot of his reputation stemmed from things outside of the ring, and we're talking UFC and you know, genuine sort of Greco-Roman wrestling, so his reputation didn't come with pro wrestling, so it was always a bit people expecting too much from the transition, and it never quite worked out in the way it I'm not necessarily going to say in the way it should have done, because I don't see a an easy transition there by any means, but probably not in the way that people hoped. I will say this for Dan Severin, though. He had a moustache that Magnum PI would have been proud of.
I think he got close to what I was kind of like thinking with Dan, because and I just remember being disappointed, because I remember I was familiar with Ken Shamrock.
He comes after Shamrock as well, and people seem get the impression that the transition is easy to make, and I think it, in credit to Shamrock, he made that transition from.
We've done wrestling before,
haven't you? Well, they'd both done wrestling before.
But never on a major league level.
But never on the major league level. And I think people looked at Shamrock and just assumed it was easy. Yeah. And it's a credit to Shamrock that that he made that transition look easy. You know, he wasn't the next Kurt Angle or Ric Flair or anything like that. But you know, no one can say that Shamrock didn't have a successful transition into pro wrestling.
I think you're absolutely right there, man. I just remember because I was familiar with Ken Shamrock in like the early days of UFC when it first started. Yeah, and it's just like that same thing where they were trying to like, you know, tag Severin into Ken Shamrock as well, and just when looking at him going like, he's not Shamrock. Like Shamrock's got like a ceiling on him, but like Shamrock's much better than this guy.
Shamrock also didn't come out in a fucking grey t-shirt for one thing.
A grey t-shirt that had a patch on the chest where he clearly poured water over his head.
Yeah, or it's just like he didn't shower. Alrighty, so moving along, Loopy Date from TPWW Forum says the Natural Born Thrillers was a disappointment in the way they were handled. They came in with a ton of hype as the next generation of WCW stars, but WCW died before any of them could become anything, and the WWF wasn't about to let any of them become stars up north. At the very least, O'Hare should have had a couple of runs with the IC or US title with his Devil's Advocate gimmick. The closest thing to an MBT success story was actually Chuck Palumbo, but that was entirely the result of his angle with Billy Gunn and Rico. Once he was back on his own, he did the generic badass biker thing for about a week, then was released. This isn't a matter of them not living up to my own personal hype so much as it is the hype they were given but never given a chance to pan out. Funk Doc from Pro Wrestling Only agrees, the Natural Born Thrillers in WCW are a good one, it's a disappointment, as plenty of internet fans saw them as the future, and they were certainly five tool athletes. Though I'm not a fan of the Devil's Advocate gimmick, like seemingly everyone else is. It's basically Penn Jillette on steroids, even down to his look.
That's a great line.
Yeah, I don't know whether I would agree with all of the Natural Born Thrillers on that one. I think probably with me, definitely O'Hare, and I think to an extent Zinjirak.
Oh God, no!
I wasn't. No. This is in WCW. I wasn't completely sold on Palumbo.
No,
and I certainly wasn't sold on Stasiak.
Okay,
and good. I was kind of like on the fence when it came to Sanders.
Sanders was the star. Sanders
was the standout. You could say.
To watch it again.
You could say that the rest of the group were average. He was above that.
God, yeah.
Reno,
yeah. Oh. Reno was in there hiding in the background.
Yeah. Okay, it's just O'Hare then.
It's one of those where you sit there, and because of the state of WCW at the time, you look at this group and think there's some promise there. When you actually look at the individuals involved, it takes a bit of the sort of the sheen off it, if you like.
For sure.
I thought Sanders was a very good talker for someone who'd had such little exposure, sort of mainstream. I thought he was a really good talker. O'Hare, Palumbo, a few of the guys, they're guys that had promise, you know, because they had the look in the first place, which both companies would have liked. And I think some of them had promise, but it was just too soon for them. They were too green. In the case of Stasiak, he was just a shit anyway. And Reno.
Oh God! I forgot about Perfect Sean.
Remember the original tandems of where it was Zinjirak and O'Hare, and then Palumbo and Stasiak. So that's why I said like O'Hare and Zinjirak, because as a tag team, I thought like, oh, okay, those guys are pretty good, and Palumbo and. Probably because he was with Stasiak, I wasn't completely sold on.
I like the way you talk about the original pairings of like of Natural Born Thrillers, like they're the original Horsemen. Dude, come on.
Yeah, I don't know if you all saw this, but
it's the original and best of Natural Born Thrillers.
But the thing is, in truth, what we're talking about is tantamount to rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic.
They're still SOL, and you know what that means.
Absolutely. You know, the thing is, we've hit the iceberg. We're taking on water. There's no hope, but maybe we can, you know, we can save a few people.
Let's repaper anyway, just in case. It looked nicer. Yeah, I think
at that stage, WCW was going down quicker than the Hindenburg.
I went to a show in Birmingham for WCW.
That's right, right at the end, right?
Yeah, 2000. Maybe it must have been the end of 2000.
It was 2000, the end of 2000. Yeah.
And it was all Natural Born Thrillers, and I think Goldberg was on the show as well. And I was always into O'Hare. You know, he had a great look, he moved well, coordination. But they were all so green, and even him. Sanders was, yeah, I like Sanders, he's entertaining. It's just too green. And when they went over to the E, yeah, they, or the F at the time, they, especially O'Hare, didn't get probably the deal he could have got, but I can see why they rub people the wrong way, knowing the politics, and these guys coming into our company and they're not even ready to be pro wrestlers. It's predictable, it's a cliche, but they were just all so green and weren't ready, really.
Did you actually see any of them being any more than they were? Did you think that, you know, Carly mentioned the word promise, but we're talking about the word disappointment in terms of did any of them?
Oh, hey, yeah.
Were you disappointed in the fact that none of them ever became really anything more than they were in WCW?
Oh, hey, well, yeah, that's the thing. So they actually, none of them became anything, yeah. Nothing at all. I mean, but yeah, I mean, O'Hare could have been an Orton Edge.
Really?
No, in terms of look, I'm not. He was so green, it was impossible to say. But if he was nurtured, but he was just. I mean, yeah, no chance.
I think I absolutely right. I think. Yeah, I didn't. I haven't lost any sleep over the fact that any of them didn't get into any kind of high plane in professional wrestling. But I think, yeah, of all of them, I think O'Hare was the closest one. I think, like Kieran was, like, you know, he had the look and everything, but. They were just a product of that desperate time in 2000, where they were just so desperate to try and find something new that can draw a crowd back in, that they just had these four guys that had the look, were green as fuck, and just thought, like, God, we got to do something. Let's push these guys. They got a look at least, and yeah, I said that they were just, it was just too early for all of them.
You know, it was too little, too late by them for the company, and it was a detriment to a lot of them because they weren't ready. I think the O'Hare gimmick in 2003 had some promise to it. I do think it's something that certainly could have gone further than it did. You know, Piper is the mouthpiece, I'm not entirely opposed to, I guess, but it didn't seem like a natural fit then. And you know, an initial feud with Rikishi doesn't do anything for anyone.
No,
but I think O'Hare could have meant more. I'd like to think that Sanders could have meant more than he did.
Sanders didn't get a
chance. The problem is, he didn't get a chance because he didn't shake hands with the right people.
He didn't shake hands with Triple H.
Didn't shake hands with Triple H
when he was injured.
And the problem is that even if he had done, and he'd minded the sort of the proverbial P's and Q's with the company, I don't think Sanders would have ever been given a fair shake because of his size.
Yeah, I think he might have ended up as a commentator or something like that, perhaps. Your fight site from the UK fan forum. I think Sean O'Hare would be a good shout. Looked like $1 million in WCW, then was given a push on his introduction to the WWF, and then didn't amount to much. We had so many suggestions for Sean O'Hare, by the way. I think maybe more than anybody else in terms of being a disappointment, which kind of surprised me. But Art Stanton from the UK fan forum took a bit of a contrasting view. Somehow this myth that O'Hare could have been the next big thing just won't go away, seemingly because he was big and did moves with a Z. He was fucking rubbish, couldn't talk worth a shit, and had a crap attitude by all accounts. Again, is that, you know, the whole thing of the O'Hare Devil's Advocate character was a product of their fantastic production and the vignettes that, who knows how long it took to do them. But they were very good as an introductory piece, but I never, ever, ever, you know, whenever Sean O'Hare had a microphone in front of his face, they did a skip backstage. The feud that he got a chance to do never really struck me as a guy who had the charisma or the ability to actually carry that over.
But you bring a guy in and... You pack. They give him Piper, so they acknowledge he's got shortcomings. Again, self-fulfilling prophecy. Carl's favourite catchphrase today. But yeah, if you push a guy before he's ready, they'll end up regretting it and taking it out on you for it. So,
John Haddock. As for right now, Curtis Axel, the son of Mr. Perfect. Need I say more? He's got the pedigree and the tools to be pushed to the moon, but he's been as flat as a Michael Cole punchline. The IC champion, tag champion, former Paul Heyman guy. He's had all the opportunities to shine on through and become the next guy, but there's just nothing there. He could have been so much, but I fear that he'll be on the McMahon future endeavours list before long.
He's probably right with the future endeavours list. It doesn't speak too well from that Ryback's back on the scene and he's nowhere in sight, all things considered. I always fear for someone when the gimmick they're given is a takeoff of their dad, you know, see Maya via Rocky and that sort of thing, you know, or when, say, a tag team is given the new,
yeah,
as in a position before their
Ted
name.
DiBiase Jr.
Ted DiBiase Jr., the new Midnight Express, all those sorts of things, they create, fairly or unfairly, they create a stigma. I don't think anyone would necessarily disagree with that. With regards to the Heyman thing, I personally, it was an ill-fitting combination in the first place.
It wasn't executed well.
It wasn't executed well. Kurt's actually, he's not particularly charismatic. He doesn't carry. Yeah,
there's a difference between not particularly charismatic.
Okay, all right.
He could be a comedy character the way he delivers lines. Okay, apart from that, he's a jump. Look, I'm sorry, dude.
It's one of my rare moments where I'm trying to be kind here. Okay. Partly because I love the entrance music. I'll be honest, I love that entrance music, but. But it's just, yeah, okay, all right, fuck it. He's got zero charisma. Yes. He doesn't deliver the lines well. The only thing I would say, I don't think he's been given that many opportunities to shine. I don't think it matters because I don't think he would have shone anyway.
Yeah.
But I don't really think he was given a lorry load of opportunities.
No, I agree. He was kind of shoehorned into a lot of bad positions.
His name's shit as well. Not Curtis Axel.
But am I the only one who loved that entrance music?
No, the music's great.
Thank you. No, I hated that as well.
The Iron Sheik from the UK fan forum, the British bulldog Davy Boy Smith, looked the part, apart from his purple, junked-up attitude phase, but his mic work was hilariously terrible throughout his entire career, and his finisher was the definition of disappointing. Thoughts on Davy Boy as a disappointing professional wrestler?
I gave Al Snow the Hardcore Championship because he deserved it.
Because he's bizarre?
That's even better.
The Bulldog was actually given a lot of chances to be a primary heel. He kind of got recycled quite a lot in that early 90s period.
Well, to that point, to steal JR's line, how many times can you repackage the British Bulldog?
Oh yeah, on the Legends Roundtable.
Yeah, in this country in particular, we've had we've almost, the word I want to use is eulogised. I realise it's a sort of a horrible word to use considering the man's passed away, but what I mean is we have a tendency to put him on a pedestal. I think there's the rose-tinted specs when it comes to the Bulldog, because you tie in the SummerSlam show and the main event and all that sort of thing,
and you're here to take Sid's squeegee to that rose-tinted window.
I wouldn't
Carl's dead.
Carl's gone.
I wouldn't,
maybe just a bit disappointed he. No, I was really wanted him. I was keen fan in WCW, wondering what he's going to achieve there. Yeah, he didn't get anything, but I don't know, probably achieved his level. I wouldn't say disappointing. You're right there, Carl.
I'm trying to desperately maintain my composure after Liam completely broke me there with the squeegee remark. I suppose the thing is, and to your point, I suppose when you look at it objectively, I don't think it was a case that he disappointed or didn't really live up to expectation. I think it's more a case to try and sort of get back to my original point, as convoluted as it was, that as an English wrestling fan, you always wanted that little bit more from, didn't you? Regardless of whether or not it was really, you know, whether it was truly merited or not, you always thought, I'd love to see him with the belt. When you take a step back and you look at it and you think, no, he did about as well as he really should have done.
In some ways, I think he actually did better. He got a lot of chances in headlining spots as a heel.
I think longevity wise, he had more chances than he deserved. In terms of actual peak of his career and stuff, he was important in that early 90s when it came over to it.
Sure.
He was massively important in that. He was a big star. Wembley Shindig as well. For me, he is what he is. Yeah.
Oh, and we're gonna have a can opening here.
Point number four.
We've got some heavy hitters here we're going to get to. Aaron, 1985 from F4W. Lex Luger. I was so desperate for him to be my next Hulk Hogan. Crowbro from the board, F4W. I bought into the Lex Express hook, line, and sinker, even all the way to the Allied Powers. Wouldn't accept that his push was done around mid-94. We've kind of waxed nostalgic and lyrical about Lex Luger before, so we don't have to get into too much depth here. Disappointment. He's one of these ones that regularly comes up along with Sid, I guess, a guy whose career never really reached what it's projected to. I personally think that he's got a bit of a raw deal here, poor Lex.
You think he got a raw deal?
Yeah, I do. Because he was projected by all these people. The reason he's a disappointment is because he was projected to be the next Hulk Hogan, mm-hmm. but no company ever pulled the trigger on him to be the next Hulk Hogan the way they did with Hogan. When he was hot in 1998, 1988, when he turned babyface against Ric Flair, those shows did the best houses of 88, and they did the dusty finish. When they did the Lex Express and the Yokozuna, they did the fucking horrific count-out finish we've talked about before.
You can't win the title on a count-out, Lex!
What are you celebrating for? And it quelled any... Granted, there wasn't a lot to the Lex Luger experience, if you will.
I don't know. Do you think, like, the reason why, like, he never kind of... You know, you were saying about, like, companies never going the full distance with him. Do you think it's just because... In each of those cases, there was actually always like a better option than him.
But if that's the case, then be fair and say that that's not a disappointment. That's just his place on the card. I think a disappointment for me is when he's given a chance, someone's given a chance or it put in position, then it fails or it doesn't live up to expectations. If you reflect the fact he wasn't, the trigger wasn't pulled at the opportune time on at least two occasions, I think that's probably, that's not his fault. I can understand that. But in terms of him himself, he is what he is. So.
Yeah. Now, granted, I'm making this defense for Luger almost devil's advocate-ish, because he was pretty terrible in many ways, completely wooden in his movements. And if I have to hear one more "oh" when he throws a punch, I'll cry. But at the same time, it's like
he was so taut. Do you know how much it hurt to
do? Yeah. But I, again, he was disappointing in the fact that he never really developed, you know, beyond a certain level. He never really became enough to really kind of force the hand, I guess, is another point. If a lot of people thought he was going to be the next Hulk Hogan, he never really had that kind of momentum independently of the push to warrant anything more than really what he got.
Fair play to you. Big man gets a push. You're not Hogan, so what? There's lots of guys in that position.
Another one that was destined to be on the list of most disappointing. Undefeated Steak from the UK fan forum says Randy Orton. There's magic in him, but you only ever see glimmers of it. He's so good that even though he's on autopilot 95% of the time, he's still one of the most popular and recognised wrestlers of the last decade. It's a shame he doesn't have a Flair, Hogan, Austin, Cena work ethic. He could have easily been the next Rock if he did. Max Power from the UK fan forum. I echo the proposal of Randy Orton. He's shown glimpses of true greatness over the last decade or so, be it as the legend killer in his initial run or when he punted Vince in the head, but it just doesn't seem to happen for him on a consistent basis, whether that's down to bad booking like bumping around for Shane O'Mac and his hamster cheeks or a lack of motivation on his own part. I suppose we'll never know. Wishbone from TPWW forums. I think Randy Orton fell short of what he could have been. The dude has had a pretty great career, but I feel like he should have been on the same level as The Rock and Stone Cold by now, and instead he's fallen short.
I don't think he could have ever been on the level of a Rock or an Austin, because to me and it's a word we've used a lot in the podcast, but charisma with Randy Orton, to me it's just not there. We talk about a disconnect, and to me with Randy Orton that's apt. The thing with Orton is that there's a few issues. The company haven't always done right by him. And I don't mean to sort of come across as overly sympathetic or weeping for Randy Orton by any stretch, but there are times when the momentum has been there and the company have made a decision or you know, they've made a choice that has hampered him. See the initial face turn and the burial by Triple H and the Viper push when Triple H buries him. And well, we could just go on about the burial from Triple H, really, in truth, when it comes to Randy Orton.
It happened at least three times.
Orton
was getting pushed and the belt always wound up on Triple H.
It always wound up back there. Funny that. But by the same token, I think one of the emailers referenced it there, a lot of the time Randy Orton is on autopilot, and it falls into that category of, is it motivated Randy Orton tonight, or is it going through the motions Randy Orton tonight?
I think it's a couple of weeks ago. I think Orton is super talented. Circumstances and his own shortcomings have probably held him back. So in that respect, probably a disappointment, because he's not changing companies like or territories like in the past. He's been in the same place for 10, 12, 15, 25 years, whatever. And now we all know, we all know him. So what? And just,
what is he, 10, 12 time champ by now?
If he's not on the show, I bet he's on most shows, but if he's not, he was on this week, who cares? He's just been around so long and now he's insignificant. We've seen him do everything backwards and forwards all the time. So what? But at the same time, doesn't have the charisma of a Rock or an Austin. Come on, I mean, Rock is, well, both the one once in a lifetime, once in a generation. Although there's two of them, guys. Orton's just not that. He was in that respect. He would have been a fantastic supporting player for a guy like that.
It's one of those where we tend to assume that there will be another guy that will just rock up with that charisma, because there was Bruno, and you know, and then there was Hogan, and then there was. I think people tend to overlook the fact that having Austin and Rock together was such a, you know, it was one giant anomaly. It's not par for the course that sort of thing happens.
Two complete freak occurrences. What Rock? Yeah. Rock is just an absolute, you know, there is no one like him. He's just a complete freak. And then Austin, was the right guy at the absolute right time, finding himself. It's the stars aligning on both cases.
Yeah, I think obviously, yeah, this is this. You know, you can mention Cena in the same breath as well. Just like two people who have just been around for so long now that we've seen almost everything that they can do, at least in their current form. I think when it comes to Randy Orton, I think when it looks at the Viper character, you know, which had a really good start. I think right now where he is, he's pretty much, yeah, exactly where I'd expect him to be with that Viper character. But in terms of like his...
I don't want to jump in, I just want to pose the question to you, Chase. You say the Viper character. What is the Viper character, really?
It was basically to get away from the original Legend Killer character, which was obviously he was being this shit-eating kind of...
Spoiled,
cowardly heel, and then to turn him into this kind of badass, maybe trying to mould him into like a Steve Austin. Really, the major potential, if there was any, for Randy Orton ended there with the Legend Killer gimmick, and all the Viper gimmick did was just prolong his career. I think in terms of like when we're talking like him in comparison to Rock and Austin, I think... No.
That seems like such an unfair comparison
It is an unfair comparison.
He's not comparable at all to Austin, and certainly not Rock. But I think at the same time, in terms of like the context of what wrestling is right now, he certainly is not one of the top two guys in the company, along with Cena. That they are the Rock and Austin of what they've got now. So I think he's kind of reached what he was supposed to do. You know, they wanted a Rock and Austin for this generation. Cena and him are the Rock and Austin of this generation.
But there's a difference between prefabbing someone into the spot and then taking off a wildfire to the point where business reflects these guys. It's just that distinction between promotional and the wrestler being the disappointment. The promotional push, inconsistent as it's been, like you said, they've put him there in that spot. Yeah. But from a wrestling performance, does he live up to the spot that he's in? Like you said, comparing Cena Orton to Rock and Austin, I don't think anybody around this table is going to think that's an argument that Orton and Cena can win. King Pitcast from the UK fan forum, Rob Conway is always the one that comes to mind for me here. For years before he debuted, you'd hear about how brilliant he was. On EWR, you put him on the roster and he'd be your biggest star in no time. And then he turned up on TV and he was rubbish. Bland as anything, he'd probably not be out of place in the mid-card of the current WWE. I could easily see him having a Best of Infinity series with Dolph Ziggler, but bloody hell, what a letdown he was. The con man.
No. Not at all. No, I mean,
if anyone look like a porn star, it's Rob Conway.
I mean, even if we ignore, you know, La Resistance and that other brutal gimmick that's just been mentioned. I mean, has the guy actually watched Rob Conway more recently when he's been in NWA and more importantly New Japan, where he's appeared on those shows defending the NWA title?
No, but he did have a bit more of a rep from the OVW days because Jim Cornette was giving him time to wrestle, and as the Iron Man Rob Conway, he came off a hell of a lot better than he did in La Resistance and as the Con Man.
Shocking, that.
It is shocking.
You can throw Rene Dupree into this as well because... He was another one.
Yeah,
was he like 21, something?
He was 19. Really? When 19?
He was 19. Really, really young.
God, so yeah, he should have been 19 when
they signed. Yeah, Conway, there was a lot of OVW guys in that class, so he probably could have been more. Yeah. PF3 from Pro Wrestling Only. This is a bit of an oddball one. It seems to me that Max Payne should have been a better wrestler and a bigger star than he was. Here's a guy who had a unique gimmick, a guitarist he could actually play, had a strong amateur background as an All-American wrestler at Iowa State, and got pro wrestling training in the New Japan dojos. He could have had at least a poor man's Bam Bam Bigelow or John Tenta-like career, but he ended up doing pretty much nothing and never developing into much of a worker. Part of it was on him. Part of it was not sticking around in Japan and coming back to the US at a time when being a good worker got you less than almost any other time in history. Max Payne is a disappointment. What do you think?
Not really, in truth. He said there about he could have had a poor man's Bam Bam Bigelow type career. Is that not really what he had anyway?
He never really, I guess the whole point is he never really stuck around or did anything of note other than shoot Johnny B. Bad in the face with a bad blast, and that was great, but...
If anyone ever deserved being shot in the face with Johnny B. Bad.
Well, even in just the term of that phrase he used, that you just end up being a poor man's Bam Bam Bigelow, well, that sells seats for me.
Surprised, actually, yeah, he wasn't around... I suppose he'd already been Man Mountain Rock, hadn't he?
Yeah, he was Man Mountain Rock.
I think an Attitude Era is like everyone was looking for talent. It would be a place for him. What was he doing around?
He quit. He completely quit
the business.
Yeah.
Well, that's bad timing, dude.
Yeah. It's been being SOL.
Yeah. Way to jump off the horse too early, I guess. It's kind of weird because my... Yeah, again, I was a young kid when I saw it, so it's funny what scares you when you're a kid, but Max Payne was a bit of a haunting presence in WCW, I thought. Like, his... The kind of the dark promos and the stuff like that. Panther Wagner from PWO. My biggest disappointment ever as a kid was finally getting to see Jerry Lawler. I had read all this great stuff about him in the magazines and had seen crazy brawl pictures versus Terry Funk. Then when I finally got to watch some early 90s USWA in Sports Channel Europe, there was this non-fighter looking guy with a belly that was fighting in a little studio in front of 100 people, and in half of his matches he was seemingly doing his dated hiding the gimmick in my trunks crap. Then he joined the WWF and was booked to have a semi-competitive match with Jim Powers of all people. Back then, deep down, I knew it wasn't real, but I was still trying to fool myself into thinking it was. And then there was this creepy looking fucker on my TV making my dad go, "Why the fuck do you watch that shit? It's fake." Years later, I became older and wiser and can appreciate Lawler for who he is and what he does, but at the time it was a disappointment, first impressions.
Yeah, when I first...
Later on, you can appreciate it.
Yeah, when I first saw Lawler, I thought he was an absolute cunt.
I thought he was, yeah, me too.
But that's because he's brilliant.
Yeah, in a great way.
Yeah, look at that. The great line to Stu Hart, "Why don't you put your false teeth in backwards and eat yourself to death?"
He had so many good ones during that period. Lawler was the hottest thing in 93 for me.
He was great on the mic in 93. I think in terms of what the what was the emailer's name there, sorry?
Panther Wagner.
In terms of what Panther Wagner has mentioned there, I think...
Old Pantwag.
Old Pantwag. All the great stuff that you hear in terms of the wild brawls with Funk and all that sort of thing, the all the stuff in Memphis. And I suppose the problem is his first impressions of Lawler come after the glory days of Memphis.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, it's, you know, you mentioned USWA there, it's what's left of it is sort of dying on the vine, if you like, which is why he goes to the WWF anyway. So I think it's probably one of those where, you know, you're seeing the, it's one of those where the horse has bolted and you're closing the stable door. So you've seen the great stuff's already been and gone. So what you're seeing are the dying embers, and that's never going to live up to the you know, the stories of yesteryear that have been you know, mythologized. Is that even a word?
There you go. Yeah, mythologized.
Thank you.
Dylan Waco from Pro Wrestling Only says Barry Windham for him is the most disappointing wrestler. I hate it, but I think the answer is probably Barry Windham. It's an odd thing for me to say because at his absolute best, I thought he was an outstanding worker. I'd rate him among the best tag team wrestlers of all time, and I could easily see him rating in my top 30 in-ring performers of all time. Having said that, he was someone with a look, pedigree, versatility, and skill set of a major star, and instead he peaked as an upper mid-carder, and even in that role, never truly realised his full potential as a star. Power Bucci from the UK fan forum, the correct answer is Barry Windham. No one... The correct answer is Barry Windham. No one has ever been as naturally gifted a wrestler. Even Fat Barry in 1999 could flow from a superplex to a pinfall like it was pissed down a urinal. But for his own shortcomings and lack of giving a fuck, it never came to where it should do for him. He'd just walk out of a company or become Fat Baz. As he said in his Pedo Feinstein shoot, when he was asked who the most overrated wrestler of all time was, he asked for the camera to be turned off and then came back and said, "Me." But he wasn't overrated, he just couldn't be fucked hitting that potential. In 1988, no one in the world was better than Barry Windham.
It's one of those where watching the stuff back in retrospect, I suppose you can't really grasp sort of what level he was on at the time in truth. I think it's probably one of those where Windham was just, he was a victim of circumstance. You know, the stars never quite aligned right. If you're in Jim Crockett Promotions, the guy's Flair. Is anyone really saying that it should have been Windham instead of Flair? No. If you go up north, it's Hogan. Is anyone saying that it should have been Windham instead of Hogan? No. That's not to try and denigrate Barry Windham by any stretch, because he was seamless in the ring.
Yeah.
He was an absolute natural. And at another time, maybe he could have been the guy, but I just think it was one of those where circumstances just didn't quite... It just didn't pan out for him.
Yeah, there were a few runs there where Windham, again, the 88, yeah, the potential of Barry Windham, everybody always raves about it. In the WWF in 1989, he was undefeated for 4 months, and then, you know, the whole counterfeiting thing goes yeah. down.
Yeah, that wasn't just leaving a company for no reason. That was a let's go underground and not be mentioned for a while.
Yeah, because we're being chased by the feds. Yeah, so there were times when, and again, like you said, you know, that whole thing of Barry Windham's motivation, which he's admitted himself, wasn't always there. He didn't keep himself in the best shape, so he just kind of let himself go, got injured, and really didn't rehab as well as he could have, stuff like that. In terms of disappointment, I can certainly see it, though. Like you said, he never really got over the hump of that kind of...
I guess what people are looking for is kind of a push to represent the perceived talent. And
yeah.
Yeah, in that respect, he didn't stick around anywhere long enough, or never once really hit the level, the peak level that maybe people are expecting. So I can see, in terms of a disappointment, yeah.
Yeah, and also the whole thing too of like, in that period of time, because he was so natural and was so good, people think, well, if he's like this now, can you imagine what he's going to be with time? He's only going to get better. And the truth is, he didn't get better. He just kind of he kept his natural ability, but it became
it just plateaued.
It plateaued, and it's kind of it did kind of go downhill. We have one more left to get to, and it is Kieran O'Rourke, who has waited patiently, Budweiser in hand, to get to this point. Your most disappointing wrestler, Kieran, and I know this is going to cause a bit of controversy.
I'm going to take my last Budweiser. I'm going to pop the lid like that. Swig a beer for the working man. And say, CM Punk, maybe you need a beer too, son. You need to lighten up and take yourself a little less seriously, because you are a disappointment to me. I know what everyone's going to... How people are coming back from this. I'm a big Punk fan. I like his promos. When he did the promo, he was, yeah, man, this guy, what's he going to be? Can he finally be something like Steve Austin? Or his own version, even. But since day one, I have been so disappointed with Punk's in-ring legitimacy, shall we say. You come out, you do your Wanderlei Silva roll on the wrist, and then you punch like a bitch. Your kicks aren't any better, and when you run around the ring, you've got a gait of a girl. Punk is good, don't get me wrong, but in terms of the shit that someone like Cena gets for his clunkiness, and you know what? Punk can't punch either. And the fact is, Punk's never drawn fuck all outside of existing wrestling fans. And I propose maybe if he's a bit more believable in the ring, maybe some other non-wrestling fans may gravitate towards him when he actually gives them something to gravitate towards, i.e. the promo. So I nominate CM Punk.
And not only is that an interesting controversial point, I think he actually did a pretty good job there of illustrating your point. So you're not necessarily saying disappointing in terms of what he became with all that. No. Your own expectations of what... Because the thing with CM Punk was one of those guys that got the big indie cred push from the internet. This guy.
And I will freely admit that it may be me as a reaction to the fact that no one picks up on that stuff. But he's always looked sloppy. Kicks, punches. I'm no way saying Cena's better than Punk. I think Punk's better than Cena as a... in-ring talent and as a consistent promo, I'd say.
But what you're saying is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you're going to criticise someone for this, you then can't gloss over it just because you happen to like that guy.
Yeah. And I think Punk, he gives as well. He's proud of his aura of maybe authenticity. He's a proper wrestling guy.
Yeah, he wears that sort of that indie badge of honour, doesn't he?
Yeah, and if you're going to call yourself the best in the world, then, well, throw a better punch. That's all I'm saying.
I will say this. I appreciate the fact that that top rope elbow was a tribute to Savage when he passed away.
Oh, that's a terrible
elbow. Jesus
Christ,
it's one of the worst top rope elbows I've ever seen.
Look, you don't have to defend him, because I know where you're coming from.
I can get some turn off this
here.
Unless you're going to agree with me, we can just move on.
I'm actually, to pretty much an extent, going to agree with what you said.
Personally disappointing in him, after he did the promo, after he won at Money in the Bank, and he went away, and he came back for an absolutely fuck all.
Yeah.
It's hard. I don't want to really cross the lines between work and true to life, but he does take himself seriously. That's the gimmick, is he takes himself seriously.
Yeah, in terms of your comments, great promo guy. And he is able to have really great matches, and actually I actually agree with you on the point about the certain aspects of sloppiness in the ring. I've always kind of noticed, and I kind of like 50-50 on this, I always noticed the kind of awkwardness, is how I describe it, of how he hits certain moves, like his punches and his kicks, or like suplexes, and it basically looks like he wrestles like a fan would try and wrestle, I guess. It's just like that kind of move set, like picking Kenta's finisher and so on, and Tenzan's freaking submission hold and stuff.
Creator wrestler is your point.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was going to say this about Benjamin before as well. Do you think some of Benjamin's problem is he's such a fan and such a big kid? He kind of Maybe it wasn't a career for him. He was just a wrestler and having fun. And that's what, you know, it's on the indie scene. You see it all the time with guys who don't connect like that, like the Benjamin syndrome, where it's because they're living as a wrestler inside their own heads. And that's exactly. Throwaway coming back.
Edit that and put it back in the brief.
Yeah.
With regards to the promo and the build up to Money in the Bank and everything that ensued, yes, they brought him back too early. And he pretty much jobbed all the way up till Survivor Series when he won the belt from Del Rio.
Yeah.
And we know it's a work, but at the end of the day, people want to suspend their disbelief and they don't want to cheer for a loser.
No.
So you can cut as wonderful a promo as you want, and it was a good promo. You can be as good an in-ring worker as you want, warts and all, as Kieran's pointed out with his punch and sort of elements of sloppiness. If you're going to bring the guy back and then job him out, fans are going to lose interest instantly.
And they sure did.
It was an indirect Lex expressing, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, you set it up and then you just...
Yeah, I completely agree on the disappointment. This is the thing, though, again, the disappointing treatment there with the push. And yeah, you mentioned, Kieran, that, you know, elements of his actual performance that are disappointing to you. If he came to me, he came in with a rep as a guy who could do great promos and could have great matches, and he ended up delivering on both counts despite some certain, you know, foibles and certain things that did go awry, but he did deliver in many ways.
But I think it's true more than on him himself, although he does annoy me, not that I've ever met the guy. Maybe I said it's probably more the perception of him of other people towards him. You didn't hear a lot of bad words said about Punk. It's all the held down stuff, and yeah, absolutely, I agree with that as well. But he's got shortcomings, and I think people who defend him don't really, people who are defending him don't really highlight or acknowledge the shortcomings as quickly as they are to people who they are detractors towards.
I would agree with that. On that note, this, I'll ask around the table, actually, to pretty much everybody. We can agree that there's certain similarities in terms of clunkiness or clumsiness between a Cena and a Punk. Yeah, is that fair to say? Yeah. Agreement? We've discussed that before.
Yes.
In the WWE, who do you think's had more great matches?
Cena.
I honestly can't answer, but I'm having to genuinely think about it, and I think that highlights the point you're trying to get at. Yeah.
Chase, I'll let you get in here as well. He's thinking. Thinking.
But again, the fact that he's thinking, it doesn't come naturally to him, speaks volumes in the same way it does for me.
Exactly, and that was the overriding point.
I off the top of my head, just using the fingers of my hands, I think it's Cena.
Five.
I was going at a time, so I had 10 at least.
Get out the abacus, folks.
Yeah, I think it's Cena.
And that's and to give some context, that's coming from someone who does not like John Cena, is not a John Cena fan at all.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of point I was getting at, is that for the best in the world stigma and like you said, the reputation he has, I don't want to say disappointing, but you'd certainly think that for somebody with that much touting, live up to the hype. Yeah. That's the thing. And ultimately, that's what this whole show is about. So I want to thank everybody for all the feedback. If we didn't get it to it this time, I apologise. So for Kieran O'Rourke.
I wanna kiss you all over.
For Carl Jones.
And over and again.
For G. John Chase.
To the necklace.
I am Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here.